Welcome to Whiskey Cast, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 428 for June 8th, 2013. Coming up in a few minutes.
We wanted to infuse something very community-oriented into this. And there were just so many elements, so many little bits and pieces that made sense that we thought, if we launch like this, it would just make sense.
That's Joshua Hatton and Jason Johnstone Yellen of Single Cask Nation and the Jewish Whiskey Company. This week, Robert Simonson of the New York Times had an article on Single Cask Nation and the unique opportunities and challenges the Jewish community presents for whiskey makers. Jason and Joshua join me later on Whiskey Cast In Depth. I'll also have your voice, the calendar of events, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department, all on this week's episode of Whiskey Cast.
Whiskey Cast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast. The definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
Let's start off with the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. The most talked about story of the week happened about 70 miles north of Haddonfield in Woodbridge, New Jersey. Wednesday, a tanker truck full of Scotch whiskey flipped and briefly caught fire in a residential neighborhood. Fortunately, the nearest fire station was just down the street, and firefighters were on the scene immediately. They managed to limit the fire to some spilled whiskey from a pressure relief valve on top of the tank. The driver of the truck suffered minor injuries. His Newark-based trucking company declined to say where the whiskey was being delivered to. Now, what we can infer is that it had to be a blended Scotch whiskey, since UK law requires single malts to be bottled in Scotland, and it was most likely a lower-grade blend, since the producers of so-called top-shelf blends generally bottle their whiskeys in Scotland as well. By the way, no one from the industry has acknowledged that it was their whiskey in that truck. In other news, let's update a story I first reported about a month ago. Maker's Mark has now started selling its Rick Pitino commemorative bottle that will help raise money for an academic support center for athletes at the University of Louisville. Bottles went on sale Friday in the Louisville area, and Pitino will be signing bottles at the KFC Yum Center in Louisville this coming Thursday. 12,600 bottles will be available. Let's also update the Glenlivet Alpha story from May as well. Now that the distillery has spilled the beans on the mystery whiskey's provenance, turns out master distiller Alan Winchester used first fill Scotch whiskey casks to mature the Alpha. First fill Scotch, I know you're thinking. Well, instead of using ex-bourbon or ex-sherry casks, these casks were seasoned with Scotch whiskey instead, then filled with new make spirit. We still don't know how old the Alpha is, since there is no age statement on the label, and the rules say they can't give the age unless it's printed on the label. Meanwhile, Queen Elizabeth celebrated the 60th anniversary of her coronation this past week, and back in June of 1953, Chivas Brothers started bottling its Royal Salute blended Scotch to honor the coronation. This week, a new version of Royal Salute was released to mark both anniversaries. Royal Salute Diamond Tribute will be available globally starting next month. Also, Glenfiddich has released its 2013 cask of Dreams single malt in the U.S. The whiskey was matured in American oak casks, then finished off in virgin American oak. Each bottle has the names of winners and their dreams from Glenfiddich's Cask of Dreams contest in the U.S. 6,400 bottles will be available only in the U.S. The golf world is focusing on Marion this coming week for the U.S. Open, but the Open Championship is coming up in a few weeks at Muirfield. Glenmorangie has released a limited edition gift package for both Father's Day and the Open Championship. It's the official Scotch whiskey of the Open. The package features a bottle of Glenmorangie 18-year-old, along with two special tumblers and a golden golf ball. Unfortunately, the gift pack is only available in the U.K. On the Irish whiskey front, Jack Teeling's Teeling Whiskey Company is less than a year old, but will be releasing a 21-year-old whiskey this coming week. Of course, that whiskey comes from one of the Cooley Distillery casks in Jack's collection. Jack left Cooley after the company was sold to Beam almost 18 months ago. And now his brother Stephen has parted ways with Cooley as well. Stephen stayed on after the sale to become marketing manager for Cooley's whiskeys at Beam, but is now joining his brother's company as sales and marketing director. In the U.S., Hill Rock Estate Distillery in upstate New York will be bottling a special version of George Washington's rye whiskey using the original Mount Vernon recipe. Dave Pickerel serves as master distiller for both Hill Rock Estate and George Washington's distillery at Mount Vernon. The whiskey from Hill Rock Estate will be labeled as George Washington's Rye Estate Edition. It'll be available at first at bars and retailers in New York and Chicago. The Mount Vernon whiskey will still be sold only at Mount Vernon. It'll be labeled as George Washington's Rye Limited Edition. A portion of the proceeds from the Hill Rock Estate version will go to support educational programs at Mount Vernon. Also, Hill Rock Estate is releasing its first single malt whiskey using barley grown and malted at the estate. The distillery will hold an open house this coming Saturday. Stranahan's Colorado Whiskey put another one of its Snowflake Editions on sale at the distillery in Denver today. Casey O'Neill emailed me from the line around 5:30 this morning to report that he was 65th in line, with another 30 to 40 people behind him. The distillery has also marked another milestone with a brand new warehouse. Proximo Spirits arranged to take over an old theater across the alley from the distillery and turn it into a much-needed warehouse. They're filling about 1,000 barrels a year at Stranahan's now. It took 4 years to fill the first 1,000 barrels. And finally, construction will begin soon on the long-planned Kingsbarns Distillery near St. Andrews in Scotland. Planning permits have now been granted for the project, which will turn one of the historic farm buildings on the Cambo Estate into a distillery. Weems Malts plans to have the stills running next summer. You can keep up with the latest whiskey news all week long at WhiskeyCast.com. But for now, that's the news.
The news is brought to you by Glenmorangie. Help us select the next Glenmorangie single malt whiskey with the Glenmorangie Caskmasters project. Sign up online through the Glenmorangie Facebook page or on glenmorangie.com.
Just a reminder, there's a week left to take advantage of the Father's Day sale in the WhiskeyCast photo gallery. Every print is 15% off through June 16th. Of course, it's too late now to get delivery in time for Father's Day, but you can always order one now and give an IOU on Sunday. You'll find the gallery in the pub section at WhiskeyCast.com. That's also where you can share your comments on the Your Voice page. This week's Your Voice segment is brought to you by Highland Park. Matt Woller from Australia had a great comment on the whiskey tanker crash this week. In his words now, whew, it was only blended whiskey. All they needed was for a local grocer to stack his delivery bike into it while carrying a load of oranges and mint, then hose it down with a passing cola truck's load, and for a brief time a glimpse of mixology heaven. Again, those are Matt's words, not mine. Now, earlier this week I asked for your thoughts on the flavored whiskey debate on our Facebook page, following last week's story on the famous Grouse experiment in Sweden with flavored versions. And as I expected, there were a lot of opinions. Stuart McCallum Minto had this to say, "No, no, no. If you want a vanilla or citrus drink, then drink vodka. I know I'm a purist, but whiskey is complex and different enough without adding anything else except sometimes water." Andrew Colville added this note, "It will happen no matter what the purists say. It's a growth industry in rum, vodka, and bourbon. Best case, it encourages more people to learn about whiskey. Worst case, it denigrates scotch." And Mike Walsh posted this comment with tongue firmly planted in cheek. "We had a guy at Scotch Club one night who decided to add a little water to his dram. He deliberately added some fruit 2-0. We almost threw him out of the club." And finally, Scott Rogers had a comment on last week's discussion on women in whiskey history with Fred Minnick. You may remember that Fred suggested Marge Samuels of Maker's Mark should be in the Kentucky Bourbon Hall of Fame. Scott's post on the Facebook page, "How is Marge Samuels not in the Kentucky Bourbon Hall of Fame? It's not really a Hall of Fame if she's not in it." If you have something you'd like to share with whiskey lovers around the world, you can always post it on the Your Voice page in the pub at WhiskeyCast.com or on our Facebook page. You can also email me. My address is comments@WhiskeyCast.com, and this week's Your Voice is brought to you by Highland Park.
My name's Daryl Haldane, Global Brand Advocate for Highland Park. Go onto our website at highlandpark.co.uk and upload your photo at Inner Circle to have your face on the walls of the Highland Park Distillery.
Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. Whiskey Live at the Highland Games is this coming weekend in Itasca, Illinois, near Chicago, along with Whiskey Live Melbourne in Australia. Speaking of that, the Australian Malt Whiskey Tasting Championship is coming up in Sydney, June 21st. The Kensington Wine Market in Calgary will hold a Last Samurai tasting of Kuruazawa and Chichibu whiskies June 18th. Milroy's of Soho in London will hold a Compass Box tasting June 20th. That same day is the Filson Historical Society's History Lesson on Women in Bourbon History in Louisville. The Bushmills Live Whiskey Festival is June 19th and 20th at the Old Bushmills Distillery in Northern Ireland. And the Gasparilla Inn and Club in Boca Grande, Florida, will hold its B4 weekend, June 21st through the 23rd. B4? Beach, barbecue, bourbon, and beer, of course. Sounds like a lot of fun. You'll find nearly 300 whiskey events all over the world at whiskeycast.com, and the calendar of events is brought to you by Laphroaig. Take a virtual distillery tour at laphroaig.com, and while you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay.
Whiskeycast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Jerry McCarthy, stillhouse operator, Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
There was a time, you know, we brought in 12 barrels, and I was asked to, I was foreman in the warehousing at the time, and it was to be handled by Noel and then myself and the supervisor in question, Dennis McSweeney. And we put it together, made it up. I was told to band them, strap them, get them onto the back of a lorry. They were being shipped off up to Dublin, and they were special. And I was told it was liquid gold. It was actually Redbreast.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know, know Redbreast.
WhiskeyCast In Depth is brought to you by Woodford Reserve. Joshua Hatton and Jason Johnstone Yellen started out as whiskey bloggers, but have since become whiskey bottlers as well. Their Jewish Whiskey Company and Single Cask Nation were highlighted in a New York Times article by Robert Simonson this week. The article looked at the Jewish community as a target market for whiskey producers. And that's where we began our conversation. Explain to me this constituency that seems to be developing among the Jewish community, not only here in the Northeast, but all over the country and really all over the world for single malts, whiskeys, and really all kinds of whiskeys.
Go for it, Josh. This is all you, stemming back to your blog.
Yeah, sure. So, Mark, as you may know, I started blogging sometime in, is it 2008 or 2009, somewhere around there. But
seems like yesterday.
Yeah, it does. But I started off as the Jewish Single Malt Whiskey Society.com, a bit of a mouthful. But, you know, it was a blog that I wanted to do, you know, review whiskey, have a little bit of fun with it, and put a little, you know, Jewish humor in there and Jewish information, too, especially as it pertained to, you know, kosher issues, if people had kosher issues and things like that. So what I found amazing and I did not expect was the number of emails and comments and tweets that would come in, Jews, you know, Orthodox or, you know, cultural Jews, non-affiliated Jews, just asking me questions. Is this whiskey kosher? Is this whiskey not kosher? Can you tell me about this? What do you suggest? The number of emails was staggering. Was really staggering. And, you know, as I started blogging and reviewing events, I was taken aback. You know, back in 2009 or 8 was the first whiskey fest that I went to in New York City. And obviously in New York City, you've got a large Jewish population. But here you are at this at the Whiskey Fest, and I would guess that 40 to 50% of the people in there were yarmulke-wearing Jews or wearing the black hats, big beards, you know, the whole thing, the ultra-Orthodox folk. And I jokingly said, you know, there's more kippot, which is the Hebrew plural word for yarmulke. There's more kippot than there are kilt at this place. And it just, it really struck me as quite odd, interesting, and very, very cool.
Well, and to add on to that point, Josh, one of our very first conversations with Alistair Walker at Ben Riach, we walked in the door and we say, okay, this might sound crazy, but we're here as a Jewish whiskey company. And he said, no, I've poured at festivals in the US, especially in New York. I know exactly what you guys are going for. And he was genuinely excited to see somebody looking after that market in the US. And that was, you know, sitting in a meeting in Edinburgh. And I never thought we'd get that response walking in the door.
And that was just the start, really, behind Single Cask Nation. But I try to explain this to me, if you can. I don't know if there is a reason for it or not, but we know that various cultural groups have an affinity with a beverage, usually from their homeland. Without being stereotypical, the Irish and the Scots, of course, have whiskey. The Brits would be known for gin, Eastern Europe known for vodka, the Mexicans for tequila, the Caribbean regions for rum. So how did we wind up with a large Jewish interest in whiskey? It's not like one of the tribes found themselves in Scotland all of a sudden.
That's a good question.
Yeah, that is a good question. You know, why it landed on whiskey, I'd have to say that's a bit of a tough one to answer. Part of what I think is the prestige of it. There's something very prestigious about good scotch, good bourbon, good whiskey in general, that when you're gift giving, you know, think of a family, their son or daughter having a bar or bat mitzvah, or you want to give your boss a gift. There's a prestige element to good scotch, and it gets passed around. And I think...
But that cuts across all cultures.
Yeah. You're right.
So give me a specific. Why do we see it in the Jewish community when we don't see it in other ethnic groups, for instance?
Do we not see it in other ethnic groups?
Well, other than Scots. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
In terms of other cultural groups, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Let's explain it that way. Other cultures, we don't see it as much. But I would agree with you, for instance, on the Whiskey Fest, because my first one, I think, was in 2004, 2005, before I ever started producing Whiskey Cask. And I was surprised by that percentage of kippot that I saw there,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure what the answer might be to why the Jewish community seems to be, gravitating toward whiskey. What I can say, as far as Jews in general go, or our culture in general, we do a lot of drinking.
Okay.
We even have a holiday called Purim. And Purim is sort of like the Jewish Halloween. So what do we do during that? You've heard the term, the whole Megillah.
Yeah.
Okay. So the book is Megillah is actually a book in the Bible about Esther and Mordecai. And there's this whole story. There's a bad guy named Haman, a good guy named Mordecai, and Queen Esther wanting to, you know, getting into a beauty pageant. To make a very long story short, as the Megillah is being read in the synagogue, you we're basically ordered to drink so much that we don't know if we're booing for Haman the bad guy or Mordecai the good guy. It's commanded. And now usually that's wine, but amongst some communities, it's done with whiskey. In the conservative movement, every Saturday after services, a lot of men's groups do what's called the Kiddush Club. And that Kiddush Club is a group of dozens of men that get together and hang out with whiskey. It's just a strange thing that's part of our culture to infuse drinking with our religion. Now that Purim festival, just so you're aware, I don't want you to think that Jews are big drunks, but that's sort of an oddball example. But in general,
sort of like the Jewish Mardi Gras almost.
Yeah, because kids come to it and they get dressed up. They dress up as Queen Esther. They dress up as Mordecai and Haman, and it's like Mardi Gras meets Halloween. It's very interesting.
So tell me how you translate this into eventually a business with Single Cask Nation, growing it from a blog, bringing in Jason, bringing in Seth Klaskin, your third partner in the group, and finding these whiskeys that are acceptable in your community.
Sure. Jason, you want me to go with that one, or?
Yeah, well, let me lead out, and then you can fill in the gaps.
Perfect.
And so this has been one of the questions that we've been getting, and so just to be clear and honest up front is, we haven't solved the kosher issue across the entire company by any stretch of the imagination. We actually maintain 2/3 of the line as kosher by nature, so the ex-bourbon maturation. That presents no problems. The new charred oak, same way, presents no problems. But we have, from the very inception of the company, maintained the right to have 1/3 of the line explore these wine casks. We launched with our Aaron that was 8 years in bourbon, bourbon wood, followed by 4 years in Pinot Noir cask. We're following it up. It's just launched to our members now. We actually have a Dalmore that spent 10 years, 11 years in bourbon, followed by a short maturation in PX casks, the Pedro Ximenez casks. And so we still have those. And even when pouring at events, even when having Jewish people coming up to the table, we still get into conversations where somebody, they really love their Lagavulin. Well, there's a nice sherry component to the Lagavulin, or they really like their Macallan. They really like their Glenfarclas. So still very much a demand for the wine matured stock there. What we've maintained from the very beginning is we're not going to make any decisions on behalf of our members. We're going to put the spirit out there. We're going to bottle the best spirit that we can get our hands on, and we're going to be respectful and have 2/3 of the line remain kosher by nature. But it's entirely up to our members to make their own decisions. And as we sometimes comment, it's between our members and their God, or between our members and their rabbi, as to what they want to explore. We do not get involved in that.
And that's because there really appears to be no set standard that's set in stone. It really is up to each individual rabbi on what they'll certify, right?
That is generally the case. The Scottish Rabbinical Board has basically deemed all Scotch whiskey kosher by nature, regardless of maturation. It only comes into the U.S. where you have other organizations such as the Orthodox Union, such as Star K and a few others that might have different opinions as far as kosher certifying whiskeys. So when it comes to the non-kosher certified whiskeys, it's up to the drinker or it's up to, you know, if the drinker wants to reach out to his or her rabbi, you know, for advice, they'll go ahead and do that. There really is no consensus, and there's arguments on either side of the issue as to why whiskey would or would not be kosher. You know, but generally we've found, and you know, Mark, you've seen this at Whiskey Fest, sherry cask, wine cask maturation tends not to be an issue. You see all these ultra-Orthodox Jews at these festivals walking around with very deep brown liquid in their glasses.
But that could be bourbon.
Very true. But I'm telling you, it's also sherry.
I was being facetious. I think it really depends on whether the rabbi is a McAllen or a Lagavulin or a Glenfarclas fan, right?
It's a very good point. And you know, not to... you know, make light of the issue. We have full respect of anybody's decision, whether they feel they could, should, or could not, or should not drink the whiskey. You know, we get it. We just also identify that there are a lot of people who are out there making their own decisions, and if they're comfortable doing it, great. If they want to stay away, you know, that's why we do the 2/3 of our line, you know, ex-bourbon or non-wine-matured whiskey.
Yeah, there was. I hope this isn't speaking out of school, but there was a very interesting moment for me at the Whiskey Jubilee last October, where right in front of the Jewish Whiskey Company Single Cask Nation table, I had an Orthodox Jewish chap and a rabbi arguing over this very point. And they were both very animated in their discussing of the topic, but it was really telling to think here are two gentlemen who are very committed to their religion having this completely this strongly differing opinion on the issue of kosher and scotch, and so for any of us to wade into that, who are nowhere near as serious in the religion as these two chaps, I think we need to be very careful.
Absolutely.
And now, you know, reiterating the point for the third time, which is why the bourbon line is 2/3, the wine line is 1/3. Everybody's making their choices. We're judging nobody at all.
Now, how did you wind up creating the Single Cask Nation Society and essentially turning it into a club? Instead of just releasing these bottles out onto the open market, you've essentially created a society for your members now.
Yeah, yeah. If I can speak to that first, Josh, and you can fill in some gaps.
Yeah, go right ahead.
One of the things that really struck me, Josh and I had a telephone conversation Thanksgiving Day of 2010, and he said to me, "Jason, I've got this crazy idea. Let me know what you think." And as soon as those words came out of his mouth, I knew that he was going to talk about independently bottling. Somehow I knew he was going to say that, and then boom, he did. And I said, that's a brilliant idea. That's a really brilliant idea. And then he was kind enough to say, and I want you to be a co-founder. And one of the things that has always been present in the relationship that Joshua and I have, and I speak to this as co-founders as opposed to owners, where we also have Seth, but one of the things in our relationship is Josh comes to this as, you know, the old Jewish Single Malt Whiskey Society blog, me, the Good Scotch Drink blog, you know, ostensibly a Jewish source blog, me, a Scottish source blog, that kind of thing. But even though we came from two different backgrounds, we had Scotch in common. And we joke in my family that I'm Jewish by proximity, where my wife is Jewish, our two boys are being raised Jewish, but I'm just Scottish. That's all I've got going for me. But in company, very clear to me that we had an opportunity to build a community here who came together to break bread, so to speak, over and around and because of whiskey. And so it was really community that drove the company and the conception of the company. And the thought there of then having a group that people would join, they would become a part of what we term the nation, where it doesn't matter if you're Jewish or Gentile, come together over Scotch. We've got a private members only Facebook group that has great conversation on it, and people coming together over Scotch. If I may, I'll tell you a very quick story. Back in the early noughts, as I think they're called, 2001, something like that, my now wife was coming over to Scotland on a visit, and my family took me aside and they said, "Oh, you know, Tamara's coming to visit." And I said, "Yes." And they said, "Tamara's Jewish, right?" "Yes." "And her family's Jewish, right?" "Yes. What are we going to talk about?" And it was like, okay, I already knew my Scottish family were crazy, but I didn't know quite to what extent. Nobody was being xenophobic about it. They were just genuinely perplexed about what a Scottish person would talk about with a Jewish person. And I, you know, my simple response was, we're all human beings. We will more than likely talk about the weather. Tamara, they loved Tamara, welcomed her to the family with open arms. Everything was easy peasy, but I've always carried that conversation with me. And the thought of Jews and Gentiles coming together and saying, what are we going to talk about? And knowing that the answer is always whiskey, made me very, very, very happy. And so that was really the impetus for really creating a community, and having a membership seemed like a way to build that community. Josh, I don't know if it
was... Well, yeah, just to quickly add on to that, getting back to what I mentioned about the Kiddish Club, as far as Jews are concerned, it's very common for a men's group to have a Kiddish club, or a woman's group, not necessarily a Kiddish club, but they have their group, their gathering, and they just get together to talk about stuff. We wanted to infuse something very community oriented into this, and there were just so many elements, so many little bits and pieces that made sense, that we thought if we launch like this, it would just make sense. I'm part of this Kiddish club. Ooh, I'm now part of Single Cast Nation. It just something that would make sense to them.
Let's talk quickly about the Whiskey Jubilees now, because as you mentioned those a couple of times, you're actually doing two this year now for the first time after throwing one together, as I think you guys described it, last year on short notice last fall. Explain the reason behind having the Whiskey Jubilees in the first place, since they do run right up next to Whiskey Fest New York, which we've mentioned a few times here. There were some changes with Whiskey Fest in the last year or so that caused some issues that prompted this, right?
Yeah. I don't know the reasons for it, but Whiskey Fest New York, which I think was always held on a Tuesday, was changed over to a two-day event, which is a good thing because it's a great two-day event. And we showed at it last year, and we'll be there this year again. We're very excited about that. The unfortunate thing is, last year as well as this year, the 2 days are scheduled right on the Jewish Sabbath. You've got Friday night, which starts the Jewish Sabbath, and Saturday day, which is when the big seminars happen, and then Saturday evening as well, and that's when, Orthodox Jews, not just Orthodox Jews, but many Jews have a sort of saying goodbye to the Sabbath celebration. And by the time that would be done with, no one would have time to make it to Whiskey Fest to enjoy it. So what happened last year, when Whiskey Fest made the announcement, I had gotten calls like you wouldn't believe, emails like you wouldn't believe, from distributors, importers, my readers, rabbis, you name it. Saying,
and I will admit, I got a few calls from and emails from concerned listeners too.
Sure. You know, just saying, what are we going to do? And it that was always followed up with, Josh, you need to help us. And so I started thinking about it. You know, we had about 5 weeks to go until Whiskey Fest, which we were already signed up for at the time. And I thought, okay, well, let me put a little something together. I think I can do it. And I'll never forget, I then got probably the last call from one of the distributors, a guy from Anchor Importing, Carl Duhoffman, really nice guy, came to me and he said, I've got this idea, you know, and maybe you should lead it off. It could be a Jewish whiskey festival. And I said, you know, it's funny you mention that. I'm actually working on it. So, you know, there were a lot of people saying, you know, could you please do something? So the idea was, let's make a good whiskey event, a decent size event that's catered with kosher food, and do it before Shabbat, before the Jewish Sabbath. And in about four and a half weeks time, we planned the whole thing. We got about 32 vendors and a little over 150 whiskeys poured, and 250 attendees came to that event. It was staggering. It really was. We did not expect to pull it off as well as we did, and we did not expect that sheer number of people. And
I was there that night, and you guys did a great job with it. On 5 weeks short notice, having been involved in event planning before and being around event planners for 5 weeks, I will publicly state that you guys did a hell of a job.
Thanks, Mark. Thank you for your support at the time. We really appreciated that as well. Having you in the room was a real honor. So thank you, too.
Agreed. And thank you for your kind words. I mean, you've been to so many festivals. You know what's good and you know what's bad. So your words, they do mean a lot.
So you're doing two this year.
So we are doing two, and obviously planning them much more in advance. New York City again, and that will be Thursday, the October 10th, the day before Whiskey Fest. And then on October 9th, in Mount Kisco at a venue called Grand Prix. Mount Kisco is in upstate New York in Westchester County. It's about an hour outside of New York City. So, you know, it's not going to, the markets won't bleed. But, you know, the Westchester County is a heavily Jewish population, and we just saw a good opportunity there. You know, just let me back up really quickly.
I am chuckling because I can just hear people right now in Syracuse and Buffalo going, Westchester County is upstate New York.
Well, it's downstate upstate. you know, when we did, before we did anything with Whiskey Jubilee, I made sure to reach out to John Hansel, Amy Westlake, and Joan McGinley of Whiskey Fest to say, I've got to tell you, I've got a lot of people calling me, you know, attendees, vendors, your exhibitors, you name it, and they want me to do this. They want me to create this event that would be for Jews that cannot make it to Whiskey Fest. Are you okay with this? And they gave me their full blessing, which was really quite something. So, you know, I still thank them for that.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because we needed to make sure we addressed that too.
Yeah, you know, they were very, very good about it, and they understood. And, you know, I received an email from them earlier this week just saying, you know, after the New York Times article came out, just saying, congratulations, you know, it seems everything's going well for you. So the relationship is good between us and them, and thankfully the Jubilee hasn't, you know, put anything between us in any way.
And for what it's worth, Saturday night after sundown, I was at Whiskey Fest last fall, and after the sun went down, there certainly appeared to be a lot of kippot in the room that night.
That is correct. That is correct.
Let's talk real quickly about your bottlings. One last question here. How hard has it been for you to source new bottlings? I know you've come out with four or five so far, and you just mentioned the new Dalmore that you're coming out with. How hard has it been to get a hold of casks, and what are you planning on coming out with in the near future?
It's we're honest to a fault, and the honest truth of the matter is it's not that easy sourcing casks. There's a huge boom in the marketplace right now. Distillers are holding on very tightly to the stock that they have. They obviously want to continue building their own brands with it. At the same time, when we have found distillers who have sat down with us across a table, listened to the business plan, looked at the marketplace that we look after, they have been very receptive and very responsive to what it is we're trying to achieve. And so of the six bottlings that have come out so far, you can just look at them and see, you know, Aran Distillery have been amazing since day one, with Ewan Mitchell and Louisa Young have just been magnificent there. Anthony Wills at Kilhoman, very supportive of us. I actually got to pour next to Anthony a couple of months ago in San Francisco, and that was a lot of fun. And then, of course, as we mentioned earlier, Alistair Walker, Benria/Glendronach and now/Glenglassa, you know, has been incredibly supportive of our efforts and completely understands what we're trying to do. And that makes our lives much, much easier. And then a new release that we're about to bring out is our Glenmurray. And Graham... And Ian, Graham, I'm totally blank on Graham's
name. Graham Cool.
Cool, yeah. I want to say Graham Yunson, and of course it's absolutely not Graham Yunson, although Graham Yunson is a lovely chap. Yeah, Graham Cool and Ian Allen at Glenmurray are another couple of guys that have just, again, been really responsive and have made a lot of time for us. And we actually recently just posted some weird, not to step on your toes, Mark, but we posted some just, you know, wonderfully amateur warehouse footage of tasting with them. So when you see the video, Mark, you will know within a half second, we are no threat to you in that side of the business.
Relax, guys. I'm sure it's great. I can't wait to take a look at it, and maybe we'll even put a link to it on our Facebook page so people can see it as well.
Oh, that'd be great.
It's very
Because Glenmurray is one of those that really isn't available in the U.S. very much anymore.
Yeah, and that's a sad thing. You know, even in the U.K., yep. There are a lot of people who just refer to them as the supermarket malt.
Yeah.
And they have limited availability in the U.S., but their spirit, their whiskeys are just fantastic whiskeys. And to taste them at cask strength, you know, without chill filtration, is really quite special. And the one that we chose a 12-year-old first fill ex bourbon. You know, with our first releases, we wanted, you know, weird, fun, interesting, and overall just good. With the Glenmurray, we wanted we wanted to bottle what we would deem as sort of the best example we could find of their 12-year-old bourbon, ex-bourbon whiskey. And so this is sort of like their 12-year-old on ultra steroids. And it is a, you know, it's a drinker. It's a session dram. It's something you bring friends over, you take the cork off, you throw out the cork because you're going to finish the bottle over some great conversation. So we're really excited to release that one. Only 148 bottles. And then, like we said earlier, we have a Dalmore that is finished 10 months, I think it is, in Pedro Jimenez. In a Pedro Jimenez cask, and then a Laphroaig, a 6-year-old Laphroaig from a refill bourbon Hagi, which is it's just a beautiful, clean, bright, embracing whiskey.
Yep.
At what point might you release something other than Scotch? At what point might you say do a bourbon or a Canadian or something like that, or one of the other world whiskeys?
Very soon. Very soon. I'm not sure how much detail we can give, Josh. We tell people at the festival circuit, we get people who say, just the same as your question there, Mark, okay, these Scotchies are great, you know, bourbon coming? And we have said to people out on the festival trail and on the pouring trail, it is our goal to get bourbon and rye out this year. So we are working on that diligently. We're still in negotiations. So, you know, again, I'm always the one who's guilty of talking out of school. So never show Jason a bird's nest, as they say in Scotland.
So in other words, watch this space.
It is, but right. But Rachel Barry used to say that all the bloody time, and it drove me bonkers. And I don't.
Well, she learned it from Lumsden.
Yes, she did.
Don't be that person that says that. And I like Rachel a whole lot. I've got a lot of time for her. But I don't want to be saying watch this space. I want to be a bit more concrete than that. But obviously, there's stuff behind doors that means you can't be as concrete as you maybe want to be. But it is our full intention to bring out bourbon and rye this year. So there you go. Josh will take the birch to me after this interview for sharing more secrets.
Oh, no, you did just fine. Yeah, I put the birch away.
You'll find links for Single Cask Nation, Joshua's Jumalt blog, and Jason's Good Scotch Drink blog in the resources section of WhiskeyCast.com. Just look in the pub. That's this week's Whiskey Cast In Depth, brought to you by Woodford Reserve. Discover Woodford Reserve Double Oaked, uniquely matured in two separate new white oak barrels, the second deeply toasted and lightly charred for a more complex dimensional flavor. Find out more at WoodfordReserve.com. Be double sure. Drink responsibly. Woodford Reserve Double Oaked Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey, 45.2% alcohol by volume, Woodford Reserve Distillery, Versailles, Kentucky. Let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with one of the original releases from Single Cask Nation, the 12-year-old Aaron Pinot Noir cask the guys mentioned during our conversation. It's bottled at 54.8% ABV. The nose has notes of red grapes, toasted oak, vanilla, honey, dried flowers, and a hint of allspice. The taste is fruity and thick with red grapes and a touch of apples, ginger, vanilla, mild cinnamon spice, and a hint of brown sugar underneath. The finish is lingering, thick, and sweet. I'm scoring the Single Cask Nation Aaron Pinot Noir cask an 86. By the way, you'll find my tasting notes for their Kilhoman and Benriach bottlings at WhiskeyCast.com. Joshua and Jason mentioned their upcoming Glen Murray bottling, and while I haven't been able to taste that one yet, I had a sample of a Duncan Taylor Glen Murray bottling sitting on my tasting table collecting some dust. This one is from the Duncan Taylor Dimensions range. It's a 20-year-old whiskey distilled in 1991 and bottled at 54.8% ABV. The nose has notes of vanilla, pepper, straw, honey, pine, and hints of toffee and chocolate. The taste is fruity and intense with a good pepperiness, hints of ginger root, almond bark, and it turns dry leading into the finish with a touch of pears, along with ginger, almond, and a hint of pine needles. I'm scoring the Duncan Taylor Dimensions Glen Murray 1991 an 84. I've added these tasting notes to the searchable list of nearly 1,000 whiskeys available at the WhiskeyCast website. That's also where you'll find WhiskeyCast HD and WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings episodes, the calendar of events, news updates, and a searchable archive of past episodes. The address is WhiskeyCast.com, and my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com.
WhiskeyCast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2013, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.